Okay, go ahead and just relate your one sort of, and maybe a little bit about why the story stands out in your mind, too, just kind of memory.
Well, Dr. Petty and I arrived the same year, and of course this was his second time around. I don't want to give the impression that I'm that old, but when he became president of the university in 1953, I was a freshman co-ed. And all during the 4 years that I was attending the university, he was, of course, very much a part of the student life, and we all knew him very well. He knew us by name, very friendly. We had many occasions to visit his home and so forth. Probably the incident that stands out in my mind to show really what kind of person he was, as well as his wife, occurred after I had graduated, but while my husband was finishing his senior year. Joe was a member of the basketball team, and they were the first, the team of 1957-58 was the first team to make a successful basketball trip outside. They left in early December, and were going to be gone for a couple of weeks, playing various colleges on the West Coast. Dr. Patty, of course, and Mrs. Patty both were at the airport to see the team off with the rest of us that were there. And in conversation with the Patties, they both mentioned that they would contact me while Joe was gone and invite me up for dinner, a get-together of some kind. As time went on, the week passed and so forth, I assumed that they would probably forget of this invitation that was casually made, and it really, I didn't expect to be invited up. I just thought that was very nice of them to mention it at the airport. But about a day before the ball team was due to return, I passed the Patties in their car while I was driving in my car. We passed on the road, and I waved at them, and I saw Mrs. Patty's mouth form a big round O, as if she remembered the promise that made at the airport. So sure enough, after I got back home, the phone rang, say 15 minutes after I had gotten in the house, and it was one of the Patties, and I don't remember if it was Dr. Patty or Mrs. Patty, who called and said, "Oh, Ann, please come up and have breakfast with us the next morning," which I did. And it was a very warm and friendly relationship with them always, but I'll always remember, particularly the morning I had breakfast with them in the middle of winter near the Christmas season, as a very, very fine experience for me.
Generally speaking, then, they were... The campus was smaller than how many students?
Well, I think we were, I don't know that we had even gotten up to 600 by the time I graduated. The enrollment was about 350 when I was a freshman, I believe.
So he could almost know all the students by name and by face.
Oh, yes, right. And he did. He made, you weren't at all surprised to be greeted by first name, on a first name basis with Dr. Patty. And he was very... very much in evidence. He'd be around the halls. Of course, a lot of the activities took place in the Eielson building. His office was in the Eielson building. The registrar's office was there, and the business office and so forth. So there was an occasion where the students and would be in the building a lot, the same building where his office was, and he would be make it a point to be out, and he would came to all the functions. You could always count on Dr. and Mrs. Patty being there, dances or activities of any kind. They would always put in an appearance and thoroughly enjoy themselves.
Sure.
It's no good, we can throw it out.
Sure, we can always edit it and pare it down and stuff like that. Some of your earliest memories then, anecdotes that he perhaps related to you or that you recall.
Now, Phil, first of all, I would say that Dr. Patty had a keen insight into people and opportunities within the territory of Alaska, and the opportunities that could be given to young men and women receiving a higher education in Alaska. The very fact that he came as a member of a new higher institution, education, that had never operated before, indicated his type of thinking, that is, accepting challenges as they were presented. A challenge of a higher institution was certainly something that, if successful, would benefit many, many people. Story often told by Dr. Patty is that on his trip coming to Fairbanks, the people he met on the boat, passengers, fellow travelers, not knowing much, if anything, about the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines. Also, the opportunities came to, and suggestions to, not go all the way to interior Alaska, but rather to stop at Juneau or Latouche and seek employment in those areas rather than going into the unknown. Well, this type of talk did not deter Dr. Patty and Mrs. Patty from coming on into Fairbanks. When he arrived at Fairbanks, and the first day of registration, he was one of six faculty members. And the initial day of registration, there were six students. It was a faculty-student ratio that, since the first day, had never been accomplished since. And the interesting points also, upon arriving in Fairbanks, they located a place to live, and quite often transportation between Fairbanks and the university was by walking along the railroad track or riding the rail car that traveled between the two areas. While walking, often grouse would be encountered, and this led to certain hunting trips during the day, which supplemented the food situation. Another point at the time was the fact that funds for salaries were not available in the first few months. Dr. Patty often remarked what excellent cooperation the business people in Fairbanks gave to the faculty members in carrying them for credit until such time as their territorial paychecks would arrive. I had the opportunity of meeting Dr. Patty in 1934 when I came in as a student to the School of Mines. At that time, Dr. Patty was dean of the college and also head of the School of Mines. He'd acquired the deanship several years earlier when Dr. Bunnell had been called to Juneau, indicated he'd be gone for about 3 months, and so therefore Dr. Patty assumed the deanship, which meant to run not only academic programs but everything else affiliated and associated with the operation of the school. Also, I had the pleasure of taking a class from Dr. Patty, my first class in geology, and I found him to be a very stimulating, inspiring teacher who was always looking for a better way of doing things. I feel that the initiative on his part certainly opened the door for many students for better understanding than the principles of geology, mineralogy, this type of instruction.
Well, was he a big influence on your decision to major in mining and to take that as one of your major interests in life?
Phil, my mind had been made up before coming north to major in mining engineering, and this was certainly no doubt in part due to the faculty that was had here. And then after being taking a class from Dr. Patty, I think my interests were further stimulated, which certainly kept me from detouring into other fields.
But what were some of the innovations that he brought to a small institution in a frontier situation, teaching what would be a kind of a complicated art to people who perhaps weren't used to an academic situation, that whole gamut?
The one point that impresses me most was the initiative he used in utilizing airplanes for field trips, realizing now we're talking about 1934, when the airplane was certainly in existence but not utilized to the degree that we are used to seeing it now. At that time, arrangements were made for students in his geology class to take local airplane flights in the vicinity to further study and actually view firsthand geologic features. Heretofore, this material had been, as we read it in the textbook. This, I feel, just greatly stimulated interest in the field as well as clarifying subject matter.
It's said that he also innovated scraping the surface insulation off of off the ground to use solar heat.
This, I believe, Phil, goes into his days of mining, placer mining in Fairbank in Alaska and in the Yukon Territory. The story behind this gets to the point of thawing frozen gravel so that the material could be dug with a dredge. The practice that had evolved up to about that time was to thaw the gravel with cold water by putting points or pipes into the ground, allowing water to flow, thawing the material, and then dredging to follow. The concept that Dr. Patty used was to remove the top overburden from the gold-bearing gravels, expose this to the atmosphere, and thereby get thawing of the gravel without going to the great expense of putting in pumping plants and point fields and this type of thing. And this worked out very successful and still is used to various degrees, depending upon the specific type of deposit that you have and the existing conditions.
Were you ever, or did you ever go into the field with him as a miner and work the fields with him and experience his firsthand his insights into the art?
No, I had not worked for any of his companies. I'd worked for other placer mining companies at the time. However, our association and discussions and attending conferences together certainly gave me an insight into the type of operation that he carried on.
As far as the university is concerned, did you what were some of the things that we can see now that he may have had his visions then, he may have discussed and that are now coming to pass?
During the time that Dr. Patty was president, he certainly carried on the traditions of advancing higher education throughout the state, giving as many people as possible the opportunity to study firsthand. Preferably as close to home as possible. As a result, he advanced the community college type of instruction within the state. On the Fairbanks campus, additional facilities were added that in turn facilitated better instruction in the various programs. Certainly he encouraged the advancement of programs, expansion of programs, consistent with the financing and student interest of the times. Rather interesting point that goes back to his early days is the type of instruction that he offered to the practical prospector. During his first year here, he designed would be mining short courses in which men in the field would come onto the campus and spend up to 6 months studying the various facets again of geology and mineralogy, petrology, assaying, mining methods. This certainly was of a great advantage to the people actually out in the field working, and showed Dr. Patty's interest in the industry and those people who were using their initiative to locate and mine mineral deposits.
Do you have a favorite story based on your personal experiences with him, both either as a student or as a member of the same faculty?
Now, there are a number of stories about Dr. Patty that took place directly with him as a participant, or that took place during the time that he was on campus. I think perhaps one of the great hoaxes of the time was the eruption of the Brooks Range. This started out with several students talking in the coffee shop, and it was based on the fact that there had been a true eruption in the Alaska Peninsula, and the students were looking forward to making a field trip down to the area to observe the phenomena. However, the transportation arrangements broke down, and the students, in discussing this, were again thinking of ways to go, when somebody came up with the idea, I believe a student by the name of Pete Russell, a geology student, but let's change the overall idea here. And so he indicated, well, the entire Brooks Range was erupting and they needed students to go up to observe what was happening and all of this type of thing. Even the girls were brought in the picture, but needed nurses' assistance and so forth. And this was carried on, and it soon passed from person to person, and the interest in people going was astounding. The final arrangements were that military would have a helicopter, and a number of helicopters at Pedro Dome the following morning, and that all those wanting to go should be assembled in front of one of the buildings on campus with their pack sacks and cold weather gear and so forth. At 4 to 5 o'clock in the morning, there'd be transportation to take them to Pedro Dome, where the helicopters would then fly them into the area. The wages were to be considerable. Well, as a result, the next morning there were a number of students that gathered there, and they waited and waited and waited. No bus showed to take them out, and about that time the hoax became somewhat apparent. People that had precipitated the hoax were gone from campus for a few days. A number of other stories about that that took place. But basically, that was the thing. Well, this all happened during the time that the Dr. Patty was president of the university.
Well, what about the drying out of the campus? He was involved in that.
This was an incident that took place at was a very serious matter at the time, and Dr. Patty was quite concerned about it. As he reviewed all of the conditions, seeing the student viewpoint, certainly from many years of experience in dealing with students, seeing the other side of the picture, he made a decision based on the facts that he had that the drinking would be controlled by the his in the way that he thought best, and that was done. And of course, this led to the very many stories that came out about drying out of the campus and the burying of tradition.
But there was a whole series of memorials and that kind of thing. Were there anything that you recall specifically about that?
No, not specifically. As you say, there were a number of events and this type of thing, and it was all done in a way that was good. Okay. And so I don't recall anything in particular that would be really outstanding other than the fact.
Okay, I'll turn the tape recorder on, Bruce. And do you have a favorite story, either sort of something that you hark back to when you think of him, either an amusing story or some memory that stands out in your mind when you think of Dr. Patty?
Well, I can't think of any particular story, Phil, but I think all the relationships I had with Patty were outstanding. There's no question about it. You're asking me to think back some 30 years and to pick out some particular thing, and it's sort of difficult to do.
What influence did he have on your career? Had you planned, for instance, to go into mining engineering before?
Well, I think he was quite influential. I was a graduate mining engineer, and I went to work with him right after I got out of school, and worked with him for 8.5-9 years, and then World War II came along, and sort of we sort of separated then.
Then, in a sense, you got your start in your career got started by being employed by him.
No doubt about it.
What were some of the areas that you worked? Did you work with him now at the university, or in his capacity as?
No, I worked with him when he was in the mining business over on the Yukon, and then out of Dawson also.
What were the circumstances of your employment?
Well, I started out as a panner on a drill for him, actually, and then I was a foreman, and then I became a mining engineer. And I was in charge of exploration and mining problems relating to production and this sort of thing.
It's said that he's been fairly innovative on Alaskan mining techniques. Do you have any recollection of that? Some of the innovations he brought to Alaska mining?
Well, I think he was highly instrumental in stimulating people's imagination, and I think as far as his operations were concerned on the Yukon, particularly out of Cold Creek and Woodchopper, he was able to apply some of the techniques that were introduced prior to his engagement in the dredging business, and then expanded little innovations to them, and I can't offhand just enumerate them, but having been one of his foremen and influenced by his imagination, why we did minor improvements here and there to suit our operations, not particularly applicable to some of the larger ones that were in.
When he was teaching here, one of his innovations reportedly was the use of airplanes to get students out to actually look at the things that they were reading about in books. Were you part of that experiment?
Well, I don't know whether it was an experiment, but I was certainly part of it. I never realized it was an experiment at the time, but of course the airplane was replacing the dog team and shoe pack, so it was just a natural thing that he'd become involved. I think he was reaching out in Alaska, looking for properties and this sort of thing, and in order to keep up with the times, well, the airplane was the thing to use.
As a student, were you particularly impressed or awed by the airplane at that early age?
No, I really wasn't, because I think that I had my first airplane ride, I think, before most of the people are pilots today. I got the first airplane ride in 1923, so I wasn't particularly awed by the airplane, but I was particularly pleased to be able to go from place to place without the dog team shoe pack.
What was your relation, Ernie, with Dr. Patty? Were you just a colleague, or had you actually studied under him, or what were the circumstances?
I arrived at the university in 1938, and this was about 4 years after he'd left the scene to go into this operation that Bruce was telling about. In the years, the first years I was here, of course, I heard all about Dean Patty, as he was called, and the success that he was making with a moderate-sized mining operation. He really was a model for a lot of people who wanted to do the same thing. He showed what could be done with ability and a little outside backing. He was, as I remember, he was partners with a Canadian mining man named McRae, General McRae. Bruce could tell you much more about him. But I really then didn't have much to do with him until after the Second World War, he came back here as president. And so my main relationship to him was as a teacher here while he was president. And I was able to observe him, and he applied the same principles and methods that Bruce says he was applying in his mining business. He was very straightforward. I don't think there are any miners that I know of who are prigs, but he had his own ideas about what was gentlemanly conduct and what was going beyond the bounds of good taste. And once or twice when the students did it, he lowered the boom in no uncertain terms.
One of the instances that you're no doubt referring to is the drying up of the campus. Could you recount how some of that? Were you here then?
Well, yeah, I was here then. I don't remember too much about it, except there was a particularly wet and wild party while he was gone. And when he got back, he got the word from a number of sources, and he as I say, Patty was no prude, but he realized that in competing for funds and in competing for the confidence of parents and people who sent their kids here, he was going to have to change the image, as we call it now, a little bit. And he did it in a very straightforward manner. Of course, that didn't stop drinking on the campus, but it stopped a lot of it quieted down the ideas and the hostile opinions, you might say, that were being generated by this. There was another one, and the people who partook of that one are still very much alive and kicking. They, it was an engineer's day, and as you know, engineer's day is a pretty wild affair. Well, Patty didn't really care what they put in their newspaper, but in this particular case, they attacked a lady teacher here, a music teacher. Attacked her personally and professionally, and he called a convocation of all the students and faculty and said that there wouldn't be any more of that. He put the two students on probation, and that was the end of it. He never held it against them. It was all settled. Made his point known, and that I think probably they apologized to the lady, and that was it.
Generally speaking, then, he ruled with more or less an iron hand, but at the same time, people talk about him as very personable. He knew most of the students on a first-name basis. Any recollections of that side of Dr. Patty?
Oh, certainly. I think Bruce could tell you his old students were always welcome, and the new students too got to know him very well. I can think of one fellow now who's working for Consolidation Coal in Pennsylvania, who had a very warm relationship with Dr. Patty, as he was known at that time. He used to be Dean Patty, and then he became Dr. Patty after he became president of the university. I can't tell you any particular anecdotes, but he helped a great number of people in the same spirit that Dr. Bunnell, the first president of the university, had done.
Was I understand those first those early years of the university, there were times when checks were not forthcoming because of holdups in Washington and things like that. Do you have any recollection of the?
Those days had pretty well gone by the time I was employed here. Bruce might be able to tell you something about that, and I know that he's mentioned it in his book, but they were pretty tough times, and I came here 4 years after Patty had left, but I knew Dr. Bunnell pretty well, and I knew that there was some tough sledding in those earlier years. By the time my relationship with Dr. Patty came along, say this was in the early 50s, the university was still wasn't over the hump, but it wasn't struggling for its life as it had in earlier times. Within the last 4 years, we purchased a group of which I'm a member, purchased his old mining property at Coal Creek. And his conduct and his the way he handled that deal were just the same way as he'd handle everything else. Very straightforward, businesslike, but also tempered by understanding that sometimes you can't come up with all the money you see you can when you see you can, and he was very, very good that way.
As far as the mining industry in Alaska is concerned, he was generally well known and well thought of. Did he bring any innovations that you can think of to mining, or inspire any aspect of the mining industry that you can think of offhand?
Well, I think I think maybe Bruce could handle that one. Have you got something on that one, Bruce?
For years, Dean Patty recommended open pit mining down in the Gila River coal field. He'd suggested that for years and had advocated it. And it wasn't until the advent of World War II that they actually started open pit coal mining there, but Dean Patty had encouraged it for many, many years.
Prior to that time, was it a
shaft type mine? It was all underground, yes, all underground. And he was quite instrumental, I think, in getting them to go to open pit mining.
I think probably another thing, and the one that I remember the most, is that he provided an example of what can be done by people in Alaska to establish mines. And our generation, the generation that Bruce and I belong to, believe that this was about the best thing a fellow could do would be to find a mine and develop it for what it could do for him and what it would do for the territory, but it's the state now, and for society and for Alaska. He provided this example, and of course there were innovations I know that he did make, little innovations in the mining business that Bruce could tell you about, but they really were applications of methods to moderate-sized operations, and they really weren't, didn't have that much of an impact on mining.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a student, we had a fire drill in the old main building on the top floor, and I was the head of the top floor as far as fire drills were concerned. And this particular day, it was in the spring, and we had the fire drill. So I took my station upstairs, and I was encouraged to unroll one of the hoses. They were in racks and hadn't been unreeled for a good many years. So I was encouraged to reel one of the hoses, and I ran down the hall, and that time the gymnasium was on the top floor of the old main building, and I ran into the gymnasium. Well, I was standing there just by the nozzle getting ready to go back, and we wind it up again, and some water started coming out the hose, so I immediately opened the window and shoved it out the window, and I kept shoving the hose out, and it went down in Dean Patty's office on the lower floor. Well, of course, after it was all over, I was called into his office, and he wanted me to explain the whole situation. And I told him, well, I took run the hose out, and the water came on, and of course, that time Dr. Bunnell came in, and he was terribly upset because we were wasting water, and water was a premium there for fires and this sort of thing, and the hose had to be dried. And Patty took my position, and he was quite firm in his contention that when I was on fire drill that I should conduct myself in a certain manner, but I was sort of castigated pretty well. But when it was all over, it was settled and never mentioned again. Of course, I got quite a few things in his office all wet, and I offered to do some work there, but wasn't necessary. He took care of it. So he was quite understanding, and he was not the type to punish you severely for things like this. I think he understood pretty well. And I admired him for it, and I never took advantage of it either. And of course, he wouldn't even let me as far as that goes.
There wasn't any malice. You didn't put
No.
Yeah.
Well, so I just shoved it out the window, and his window was open, and the thing rattling back and forth just went into his office. That was all.
I might finish this off by bringing us a little more up to date. Dr. Patty's lived a full life, and we're all happy that it came fast and he didn't suffer very much. About 3 years ago, I was on Coal Creek with him, and he was showing us around, and we had to climb over a lot of tailings, and they're pretty hard to get through. And he says, by golly, last month I broke two ribs, and I'm a little bit stove up, but before we were through, I think he was helping me across those tailings. And he wrote recently, I think within the past year, that he decided to hang things up. He'd finally given a sleeping bag to his son, and he was through with weekend hiking trips. So I think this indicates that he did have a long, full, active life.
Ready to go, so. Yeah, okay.
Well, for starters, this is Charles Keim. When I got out of the University of Washington in 1950, I told the School of Journalism that I had planned to go out and get approximately 5 more years of professional experience before I began teaching writing. And I was news editor of the Port Angeles Evening News as I neared that 5-year mark. I got an offer from the state of Washington, the state of Arizona, and then a call from Dr. Ernest N. Patty of Seattle. He had contacted the School of Journalism and his son Stanton, and my name had been thrown into the hat to come up here to teach English and journalism and set up the public relations office. It was then called Information Office for the university. I'd been born and raised in eastern Montana, and I was accustomed to snow and cold, but my wife, and we had one daughter, Janet, then, were not accustomed to the cold. And my wife is a former professional model and a woman who had run a school of ballet, hardly seemed the type of a person to come up to the territory of Alaska. Alaska appealed to me because of my background. Also, I had learned even then that as a consequence of World War II, that everything that I was doing in life was kind of anticlimactic, except, of course, my marriage and the birth of our then first child. And I felt that a new frontier would pose constructive challenges for me and at the same time enable me to fulfill a sort of vow I'd made to myself in a stinking slit trench in New Guinea during World War II, that if I was spared by the war, that I would try to make this place a better world to live in with whatever abilities I might possess. I felt that teaching would enable me to do that. My wife and I were invited to Ernest's and Catherine's new home in Seattle, which interestingly wasn't too far then from the university and where I lived near the university. And he asked me why I wanted to teach, and I explained to him just as I have just now explained to you. And I said I felt now that I did have, with my pre-war, my war, and my post-war professional experience as a writer, that because I taught while I was in an Army hospital for 2 years, I took end-of-course examinations and I taught writing courses there, even put out a weekly newspaper. I was in 4 hospitals for 2 years. I felt that I was now ready to teach at the university level. And I did raise a question about what I could do in Alaska, because I had to think of my wife and my family. Dr. Patty didn't know me too well then, and he said, "Well, Mr. Keim," he said, "I understand what you want to do in life, and I understand why you want to do this, and I can even understand you're raising a question about going clear up to Alaska to do it. But," he said, "take a look at me." He said, "I did the same thing at about the same age. When I got out of school, I went up to Alaska," and he said, I put in time at the university, and I went out into the professional field, and now at my age, I feel that Catherine and I are entitled to slow down a little bit and to benefit ourselves somewhat for what we've done. Enjoy life a little bit more." He said, "Look, I've just built this new home, but," he said, "I've already accepted the presidency of the University of Alaska." So he said, "At a time I'm ready to slow down, I've decided to go to Alaska because I feel they need me, and that I know from experience that what I will do will show and count. Now you, starting out on a new professional life as a university teacher, perhaps could do the same." So he said, "It'll be a challenge for you." And he said, "Will you do it?" And I said, "Yes." When I got up here, I of course became intimately acquainted with then President Patty, because in addition to teaching, I also was the director of information. And as you might recall, even in those days, a director, as now, is equivalent in brass or status as a dean, to a dean. So I was privy to a great many of the president's successes and problems. And he achieved some major successes. He also encountered some major problems. Alaska was beginning to metamorphose from a territorial status to the status of a state. And he was very strong in his support for statehood. We talked over the possibility of having the Constitutional Convention on the campus here. It would focus both attention to the campus, and Lord knows the university has always needed support, but it also would be a center for a Constitutional Convention where we did have a major library. We had the new facilities, Constitution Hall, it's now named. This new student union had just been built. It wasn't quite finished, as a matter of fact. And so the Constitutional Convention was held here. And I do think that it did help the university. I also think it helped to come up with a good constitution, because these people were in an academic situation. They had quite a few experts available to them. Certainly they had a library, even in those days, it was available to them. They had facilities. And we were just geographically the center of the state, the territory, to be trite, the hub. Well, Dr. Patty had terrible struggles getting funds. This territory had a very small population. Even now, 7/10 of our population has come in since 1940. And we're talking about 1953-54. There were tremendous demands for very limited funds all over the territory. And fortunately, there was established the Alaska Public Works Program, APW, which provided us with matching funds for the construction of dormitories. Dr. Patty recognized that in order to enlarge the student body, in order to get the support for that student body and the other sources requiring support on campus, that we had to have more students. So if we could get the buildings that would house the students and get them for 50-cent dollars, because we'd get 50 cents for each 50 cents we spent, or a dollar for each dollar we spent, we could build the dorms at a much lower cost. But even then, when we could build them on 50-cent dollars from state fund, territorial funds, he had a terrible struggle because there were so many other demands for funds throughout the territory. He concentrated on building dorms. He also concentrated on building programs. A great many people have said that each one of our university presidents came along at the right time, and I believe that. Dr. Patty was not only a builder of buildings, but he was also a builder of programs. And one of the reasons for his success was, and I think we've had many success, all of our university presidents have been successful in their own time and by their own right. But one of the reasons was that his inaugural address, I can remember it very plainly, he had me read it. He had come up here before he came back to Seattle. and it kind of had been inaugurated. But he quoted Goethe, the essayist dramatist, who said, "Be bold." And his inaugural statement was titled, as I recall, and it's in the Farthest North Collegian for 1953-54, was "Be bold." And he said that one must be bold. He can't just sit back and watch the world go by. He has to grasp the world, grasp what it means, and grasp the role of leadership, and push ahead despite opposition from this source or that source or that source. He recognized, as do most leaders, that a leader has to march out in front, and he exposes his back to a great many barbs and to a great many people. But on the other hand, he's the man who sets the pace for the march. And if he's a good leader and people recognize it, they're going to hurry to catch up with him and to be highly supportive. And President Patty had the vision, he was a brilliant man, to recognize that people do follow a good leader, but you have to be bold to assert your leadership. Professor Cashin came in to see me one day. He was then a dean, and that was after Dr. Bunnell had died. Professor William Cashin, he's now retired. He and I kind of took turns in designing the various bronze plaques you see in the various buildings around the campus. Well, I had just done the one for Wickersham Hall. It was his turn to do one, and besides, he knew Bunnell so well that it was only right that he do it. He did the one for Bunnell that's in the Bunnell building. I was in room 213 in the Eielson building, and his office was right across from mine. And he came in walking one day with a message that he was going to put under this plaque concerning Dr. Bunnell. He wanted to use the word pragmatist. The word pragmatist. But he said that he felt that pragmatist had a kind of a sort of a negative nuance to it. And he said, "So I've come up with a couple of other words that the general public, in viewing this plaque, will understand in a very positive way." He said, "What do you think of this wording, particularly the two words, practical idealist?" And I said, "Well, I think it fits Dr. Bunnell quite well." But I thought even then, working closely with President Patty, and then working for quite a few years during his administration very closely with him, that the words apply equally to President Patty. He was a very practical idealist. Now, by idealist, I mean the sort of a man that wants to gain better things for more people and feels that more people should have better things, and that some way or other there are methods to acquire these better things. But you don't just sit back and wait for them to come along and be acquired. You have to be bold and go out and seek them, despite cries of anguish from this little group, or cries of anguish from this little group, or other deterrent forces. He believed that the greater good had to prevail. He didn't believe that the end justified the means, but that the greater good had to prevail, and a leader, as a president of the university, he had to be bold to see that the greater good did prevail. He knew Alaskans. He He had worked with them for a long time. He had ample evidence that he had worked for Alaska to put into his hip pocket and throw on the table as he went out and talked to Alaskans and said, look, you wanted me to be the president of your university. You've got to help me. And he didn't on occasion mind telling people with a fair degree of firmness, look, I gave up a lot to come back to Alaska because you people wanted me. Now, I assume you wanted me. What you can do is support me now that I'm here. President Patty was a very humane man. I've seen him get tears in his eyes as he's listened to some woeful story from some student who legitimately could feel he was in a precarious, woeful situation. He was sensitive to other people's feelings. I've seen him go out of his way to provide extra work for extra funding for people who, for one reason or another, had a better claim to need than others. And he was not only sensitive to other people and loved people, but he was deeply attached to his family. One time during a rather bleak time for funding for the university, I sat in his office with him and talked about the future of the university, how we could get more support for it, how he really could get more support for it. And he was feeling very, very sad that day. First of all, it was the anniversary of his son Ernest's death. And he'd had some of these university problems piled on top of that sadness. And he told me that story, and he told me about his feelings. And again, tears came into his eyes. And of course, he then said, of course, what has supported me all the way through is Catherine's love for me, as well as for Stanton and for Dale. He said, she is my right arm. And he said that all of the time that she was alive here. And she was. Just as he viewed his task as being the need to build a better and growing university to meet the growing needs of a growing territory metamorphosing into a state, his wife viewed her responsibility to not only support him in the many ways a good, loyal wife can support a husband, but also to help to bring more gentility, more culture, more humanity to the university campus.
I'm thinking of some researcher down the line.
Okay, you tell me where to go. Go ahead. Just as the buildings on the campus became the center for teaching, research, and public service, Catherine Patty turned the new president's residence into a classroom, a laboratory, and a home for students, faculty, administration, and all the stray Alaskans who came to this center of the state and the university for whatever possible reason.
We should think about the children who don't have the opportunity. For instance, in Kobuk, there, Eskimo dancing was suppressed decades ago, and there is no way for the villagers can see no hope and no way to get Eskimo dancing back into that village. There's just a one-room schoolhouse there. I've been there. There's a population of 55. But sometimes there's 100 or 150 people in the village as they come in from